So anyway, but Riley and Scott, you guys did a great job. I appreciate what you guys shared last couple Wednesdays as we continued through Isaiah. So if you guys have a Bible or some way of following along, we're going to pick right back up and head to Isaiah chapter 46. Remember Isaiah, I'm sure you don't need to be reminded of this, but he's the prophet who was speaking to the southern kingdom of Judah and Jerusalem. The section that we're in now is most probably written after the Assyrian invasion had taken place. And this whole section that we're in that started in chapter 40 and goes through the end of Isaiah shifts its style into a rhetorical type of sermon where basically Isaiah is preaching comfort and hope to Israel. And he's reinforcing God's big plan of salvation for Israel and what his purposes are here. Now, Scott and Riley covered chapters 44 to 45, and we were seeing this contrast that God was making between himself, the living God, and the false idols that of paganism that were surrounding them. And there's sort of this back and forth kind of rhythm that was developed, that was happening there in those chapters. And the emphasis has been in here about how that God is the only true God. There's no other God. There's God, and then that's it. And all the other gods are a sham, and he's sovereign, and he's in control, and he's the one calling the shots, and he alone is going to be able to save us. And so there's, in these chapters, there's a lot of repetition you'll have noticed that comes up, and even tonight in what we're looking at here. Last week, as Riley went over this, God was declaring that he could use whoever he wants to accomplish his purposes. And he was pointing towards, King Cyrus and somebody who was very unlikely to be used by God to actually deliver Israel. But God is the one who calls these things, or God's the one who makes these decisions. And then reinforcing this fact again as it was closing out that God alone is the one who's going to be able to save his people. In the context, he was talking to Israel. But we understand that in a larger context, he's talking to all of us who've cast our lives onto him as his people. So the chapter finished up, chapter 45 finished up. God was making this call to all of mankind, basically, again, gathering together, calling everybody to make their case. And again, declaring that he's the only God there is. He's the only source of salvation. All these worthless idols of human craft are going to get you nowhere. So tonight he sort of sums up this section. It began in chapter 44 and it kind of concludes here, making this contrast between the false idols and the living God and restating again that salvation is found in him. He's repeating this theme. He's emphasizing it. He's trying to get the point across to Israel. And it's all comes in the form of a poem. And so that's kind of what we see represented here. There's poetry in this, and these stanzas are being repeated as God's trying to emphasize this point. So if you're there in chapter 46, we'll begin here with verse 1. He says, Bel bows down, Nabo stoops. Their idols are on beasts and livestock. These things you carry are borne as burdens on weary beasts. They stoop, they bow down together. They can't save the burden, but themselves go into captivity. All right, Bel and Nabo, they were the two chief gods of the Babylonians. And Isaiah is envisioning these two gods being carried on a procession. You've seen that kind of thing, I'm sure, before, where they, people will oftentimes in pagan institutions will place an idol on a cart or maybe on the shoulders of their followers, and they'll take them on a parade through a town or wherever, and the people line the streets to honor the gods as they go by or the images that go by. But here, as he's describing them, he's saying that they're bowed over. It's obvious, there's a sense that their own inadequacy is represented even in the way that their image is presented there. They're bowed, they're stooped over. And then he describes the animals that are carrying them. He paints this picture of the animals, they're huffing and puffing as they're trying to carry these heavy idols because they're a burden. They're hard to carry. And there's a point that he's making in this, and that is that idols are inherently burdensome. I mean, he's saying this in a literal sense, but there's a message that he's trying to communicate in this, that they're burdensome. And Isaiah is seeing them the idols themselves, he even says not only are they burdensome, but they themselves are going off into captivity. And again, he's forecasting this time when the king of the Medo-Persians, Cyrus, is going to actually destroy the Babylonians. And so their gods aren't going to be able to save them. The Babylonians' gods aren't going to be able to preserve them or save them from their fate. They themselves are going to go off into captivity. And in the ancient world, when a country would go in and they would conquer one land, everybody would make the assumption that their gods had been conquered as well. So that's the concept behind this, that they're not able to save, they're not able to preserve. So not only are they burdensome, not only are these idols a big burden and a hassle to carry around, but they're impotent to do what it is that everybody thinks that they're going to be doing. They're honoring them in the streets because, well, obviously they're putting their hope and trust that these are the things that are going to save them. And ultimately, they can't even save themselves. I remember when an opportunity arose for me years ago to finally make my living as an artist. You know that like only 4% of artists in the United States are actually able to make a living doing art. And so that was my dream job. I mean, my whole life that had been my dream job, to be able to do this, to be able to just do artwork and I wanted that so badly. That was really all consuming to me, to be able to get to that place where I made my living doing the artwork that I wanted to do. And I'll readily admit that becoming an artist, a full-time artist who earned his living doing his craft, had, for all intents and purposes, become an idol to me. That was really, really important to me. And I remember before I'd had that opportunity, I'd work on some piece of artwork and I'd sit back and think, man, I wish I could do this for a living. I just wish I could always just do this and I'd finally be happy. And see, that's one of those clues. That's one thing that you can actually pick up on right away. The moment we start looking at something, saying, well, this is going to be the thing that finally fulfills me, and it's not God, we can be pretty sure that at that moment we're sculpting a nice little idol for ourselves. Anything outside of God that we look to for fulfillment or wholeness is the pathway towards idol worship. So when I finally made it to the place, I was working as an artist. I was earning a living for my family as an artist. And all I had to do all day long was paint these really cool paintings. And I was sure this is going to be all I'm ever going to need. This is perfect. This is my job and stuff. And I still remember the day when I was in the middle of these series of paintings that had to get done. And I knew that I couldn't stop working on them until they got done because there was a deadline over me. And I remember stepping back and looking around the studio and thinking, I hate living as an artist here, making my living as an artist. This is awful because it had become a burden to me. Because I never was doing any sort of artwork for my own interest anymore. It was a hassle. Art and everything associated with it had become a burden. I felt like a slave to doing my art. It was wearing me out, and far from fulfilling me, it left me way more dissatisfied than I had been before, because all of my expectations had fallen short in what I'd put my hopes in that was going to fulfill me. I'm sure everybody here has got their own stories, their own experiences of something like that, of those obsessions that we have that we hope are going to be the thing that finally satisfies us, and they end up letting us down. They're not able to do that for us because we, as human beings, we're idol makers. We just are. That's the reality of it. We crave those things. We look to gods, and Riley and Scott both covered this. That when we talk about idols in our culture and in our time, we don't want to limit this to the idea of pagan images, but we create idols all the time, like I did with my job. We'll look at gods like money or power or success or sex or whatever those things are. We obsess over relationships or hobbies, and we think that we're going to find our fulfillment and our sense of significance from these things, but they never do the things that we expect them to do. And we end up creating so many more burdens along the way. We'll obsess over a relationship that we feel like we've got to have, and it becomes an idol in our life. Not that God's against us having relationships. Obviously, this whole thing is about relationships and marital relationships and good friend relationships. Those are God's design, but we can put an improper emphasis on those things. We can end up loading our expectations onto a fellow broken human being, loading expectations on them to fulfill us in a way that only God is going to be able to do. And And all it does then is create more burdens, more needs, because now we've got this angst of unfulfilled expectations within relationship. All it ever does when we start creating our own idols, our own ideas of how it is that we're going to be fulfilled, all it ever does is create more burdens for us, more trouble, more angst along the way, more dissatisfaction. We load our expectations on these gods of our own crafting, and we hope that they're going to satisfy us, and when they don't, we just end up being crushed by it. Usually we're worse off than we were when we started that whole process, because crafting gods is requiring of us ever-increasing portions of our resources and our devotions. It's hard work, crafting God. It takes a lot to keep all of that going. And not only that, it takes all of those resources to keep, you know, to keep the needs satisfied that those gods create, and to try to alleviate the new burdens that develop along the way as we've made these new gods. It's like a person with an addiction. It's very much like that. They crave a drug that they believe is going to satisfy them, but the high is temporary, and then it comes with this new need, an ever-increasing burden of obtaining more of the drug, until finally a person gets reduced down to this one-dimensional cycle of consumption and need that never gets satisfied. It's dehumanizing along the way, but that's the same thing that happens to us in our pursuit of idols, in our pursuit of that thing, that elusive thing out there that we think is going to fulfill us or finally make us satisfied that isn't God. Any God that we craft is going to weigh down our life with more and more burdens along the way, and they're never, and we can count on that, they will never do for us what we think they're going to do. They will never provide for us what they promise to provide. But, on the other hand, verse 3, God says, "Listen to me, O house of Jacob, all the remnant of the house of Israel who've been born by me from before your youth, carried from the womb, even to your old age, I'm he, and to gray hairs I'll carry you. I have made and I will bear, I will carry and will save." We quoted David Juzik before here when he said, "Don't trust in the gods you have to carry, trust in the God who carries you." And God's making this poignant contrast here between the false idols of Babylon, who are a burden to carry around. It's a big job to lug those things around. And he points out that he is the one who has carried his people all throughout their history. In contrast to gods that you got to carry, God's reminding Israel, "Man, I've been there all along. I've been carrying you from before you were even born." And the words that mean bear and carry appear 5 times in these 2 verses. God's definitely trying to make a point here about his role in our lives, his purposes, his desire even in our lives. He describes himself like a mother who bears and carries her children from the womb to birth. And we can all identify with that. We understand that unique relationship that's there. This child forming in her that she carries first in her body. Then when the child's born, she carries in her arms and she cares for and provides for. And what a beautiful picture that God represents himself as in this way. But you know, a child is going to grow and get to the place where he's not, you know, it's a rare thing to see a mom carrying around her 18-year-old child. I mean, that's just not something that takes place. But that's where the analogies break down. This is where God transcends the analogies, because there never comes a point in time when we ever outgrow our need for God to carry us. There is never a time when we move past or mature past our deep need and dependence on God. And he says, even to our old age, God has his arms under us. God has carried his people this way. And he repeats this declaration that unlike the gods that we create, unlike the gods we make, he made us, and he carries us, and he does this for the purpose of saving us, of rescuing us from everything that's dehumanizing us in this life. It's the absolute antithesis of the gods of our own invention, the gods that we craft. The gods that we make, we have to carry, and they create burdens, and they can't save us at all. The God who made us carries us, and he alleviates our burdens, and he's actually the only salvation that there is. It's the complete and total antithesis of what it is that this world offers to us in the form of a substitute, in the form of a substitute lover like God. For Israel, reading this, it was meaning to comfort her during that time when she was going to go away into captivity, when Babylon was going to come and destroy Jerusalem and carry the Israelites off. It was intended here to remind them that God was carrying them still, no matter what was going on. God was with them, and God was going to bring them through this. He was there even before they were born. He's carried them all through this story. He's going to carry them on into the final stages of it. But for us, we've got this great encouragement here that no matter how weak we may feel, no matter how beat up or wounded we feel by this life that we're living in our weak and our wounded condition, God loads us onto his back and he carries us. That's the idea that's coming through on this, that God is the one who holds us. And whether we've known him for only 20 minutes or 20 years, God is carrying us. God continues to carry us. In fact, I would think that most of us can look back into our experiences that prior to even knowing him, way before we even knew him, we can look back into experiences that we had and say, you know what, God was there in that. Even before I was born, God was carrying, both literally and spiritually. Before we were ever born into this new birth, God was carrying us. God was looking after us. God was hedging us and guiding us in this direction. And here's the thing that we have to remember, and the thing that he's trying to get across to Israel, and of course translates now to us, is that if he's carried us this far, he's not going to drop us now. He's not going to, you know, get absent-minded along the way and then we slip out of his hands somewhere. We might get so beat up by life and the things that go on. We might say to ourselves, I'm done. You know, I just can't make it. I just can't take one more step. And what we see here is that God is saying, no, we'll make it, as he carries us on his own back. We'll make this. We'll get through this. God identifies himself with us. He doesn't just stand at the finish line coaxing us on, saying, come on, come on, you can do it. Let's do this thing. God is right there with us, step for step. And he carries us along the way. And we never mature beyond the need for that. We never somehow get our footing so clearly set that we don't need God to carry us all the way through, no matter how beat up, no matter how weak we may feel. God is there, and he's saying to us all along, we'll make it. We'll make it. I've got you. You just hang on. I've got you. So this is, you know, this whole section here, this is covering our past. This is before we were born. It's in our present and the circumstances that we face, and it's on into our future, into the gray hairs that we'll experience. Sometimes we get so wigged out by what may happen to us in the future. Because we've experienced pain somewhere along the way, we start to worry and obsess about future pains and future things that could take place. And God in the scriptures is always trying to remind us that he's there in the future too. That we don't want to imagine a future somehow, somewhere out there where he's not carrying us, where he's not in control of this, where he isn't taking a keen interest in our welfare and looking out for what's best for us. He's carried us this far. We can trust him. He's going to carry us all the way home. He's going to get us there. He's going to do this. That's what he promised Israel. I believe it's a promise to us as well. He gets to verse 5. He says, to whom will you liken me and make me equal and compare me, that we may be alike? Those who lavish gold from the purse and weigh out silver in the scales hire a goldsmith, and he makes it into a god. They fall down and worship. They lift it to their shoulders. They carry it. They set it in its place, and it stands there. You can't move from its place. If one cries to it, it doesn't answer or save him from his trouble. Now, I like the way the message words this. I'm going to put that up there because, you know, Peterson, he's hilarious. But here's how he words this. People with a lot of money hire craftsmen to make them gods. The artisan delivers the god and they kneel down and worship it. They carry it around in holy parades, then take it home and put it on a shelf. And there it sits, day in and day out. A dependable god, always right where you put it. Say anything you want to it, it never talks back. Of course, it never does anything either. This is Isaiah's last contrast. He's been doing this. He did this in 44 and 45. He's been doing this. This is the last contrast that he's going to make this way, showing, you know, the stupidity of worshiping an idol, something that we tinker with and then lay down, prost, date before it. I always get that so stupid. I don't even know why I use that word ever again, because I never get it right. So anyway, you know, bow before it and all. But he's just pointing out that it costs a lot of money to hire skilled labor to make a god. I mean, yeah, it takes a lot of money to make a god. And this god that is so dependent on human effort, not only human resource, but human effort and skill to make it happen, is the thing that they bow down to and they worship. The thing that wouldn't exist except for human intervention is the thing that they're going to worship. And it's a dependable god in that it's controllable. And there's the thing. See, we as human beings, we love that sense of control over things. So when we put a god like this on the shelf, it's wonderful. And it's like Peterson describes, it's dependable. We're in control of the thing. So if we want the god to face this way, well, we just go and move it. And now that god is facing that way. We're in complete control. We can even get a couple gods and have them play together. And, you know, it's all completely up to us in the whole thing. But just don't expect them to answer your prayers. Don't expect them to actually be of any help or to save you, because they're useless for that. But see, this is interesting, because this is not only showing us the uselessness of man-made gods, of the things that we can create, but it's also revealing some of the why we as humans want to worship a false idol or another god. We like that illusion of control that it gives us. We like that. We like the idea that I can shell out this amount of money and I can get this thing crafted the way I want it, and I'm the one who's going to put it where I want it to be. We like that illusion of control. Gods of our making, they're dependent on our resources and our ingenuity and our effort, and we feel so much more in control in that sort of thing. When we make a god out of our job, it's a great thing for us, because we're dealing with something very tangible there. And we can look at that and say, well, if I work hard enough and I put the right amount of effort into this thing and I slam on this thing, then I can make something happen here and things are going to go in my favor. And we have that illusion of control. But the point that's being made here is that those things that we control also require our control, and for that reason, they can't save us. Things that we believe we're in control of also are going to require our control, and that eliminates them from being anything that's going to be able to rescue or save us or make any sort of impact that way. They can't provide the life that we're longing for, the wholeness that we crave in that, because it's dependent on our skill at that point. We like the illusion of control that comes with having a god that we can exert our own influence over, but when trouble comes or things start to fall apart, our idol can't save us because it is dependent on our skill and our ability. And our skills and our ability are very, very limited and extremely finite. Anything that we've created depends on us, and by definition then is unable to save us from the things that we face. By default, we can't depend on them because they depend on us. And that's the main point that God's trying to make here. We can carry our god, it cannot carry us. And that's the bottom line. That's the thing to always remember. If our god is that tangible and we can exert our control over it, it cannot help us. It can't save us. And it will never provide us the wholeness we're looking for. We want to trust in the God who's carried us all along. We want to trust in the God who's at work, not the gods that we have to work to make something happen. In fact, that's God's next point when he gets to verse 8. He says, remember this and stand firm. Recall it to your mind, you transgressors. Remember the former things of old. For I am God and there's no other. I'm God and there's none like me, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times, things not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand and I will accomplish all my purpose. Calling a bird of prey from the east, the man of my counsel from a far country, I have spoken, I will bring it to pass, I have purposed, and I will do it. Now, over and over and over again, God is using terminology that is action terminology. He's speaking of what it is that he's doing, what it is that he's accomplishing, everything that's going to be taking place here. And it's this contrast between himself and these worthless idols of human creation, where the idols do nothing. They sit on a shelf and they do nothing. God declares what he has, what he is, and what he will be doing as he's working in this, as he's an advocate of his people. God is at work. He's doing, he's planning, he's purposing. Where skilled craftsmen have to come in and shape an idol, God is shaping history to suit his purposes, to make his plan come to pass exactly the way he wants it. And he's proven that he's the shaper of history by revealing to his people the things that were going to come to pass long before they ever happened. He's the one who revealed to them. He's doing this even here, speaking to the Israelites and forecasting Cyrus 100 or so years before he's ever going to come on the scene. So he's doing this to let the people know 100 years from then, who are going into captivity, not to fret. God's writing this history out. God's in control of this. And long before it ever happened, God already had his plan in place as to how he was going to resolve this for his people. It was going to come in the form of Cyrus, a Gentile pagan king, somebody completely unexpected. No one thought God was going to use someone like that, but he's going to release Israel back to the promised land. But the point of it is that God's been the one who's been shaping this all along, and long before the crisis came, the solution was already in God's mind. And those are the things we got to keep in mind in our lives as we deal with the dilemmas of life that come along on a regular basis. Long before this trouble ever hit our life, God had his solution in mind. We just keep our eyes open. We keep our trust in him and be ready for what it is that he's going to do. Don't define for God how he's going to do it, because he's going to use Cyrus sometimes. He's going to use, you know, amazing things that we're less like, oh no, God would never do it. God, you're doing that? That's just what he does. It's, you know, he's a box busting God. He's not going to confine himself to what it is that we define for him. He's God. And he's making that very clear here. Nobody's restraining me. I'm going to perform what it is that I've determined to do, and no one's going to restrain my hand. I'm doing what I've planned all along. And so that's what we want to do. We have to remember that in all of the things that we face in life, and all the various twists and turns and the troubles that we go through, God is the one who's writing our story. He's written our history out long before we've even experienced it. He knows it, and we have to trust him that he's writing us well. We have to trust him that his purposes are for our best, that he's got a good ending in mind, no matter what it may look like now. He's got something good at heart for us, and we can trust him with our lives. We can trust him in the things that unfold. Well, we finish up here with verses 12 and 13. He says, "Listen to me, you stubborn of heart, you who are far from righteousness. I bring near my righteousness. It's not far off, and my salvation will not delay. I will put salvation in Zion for Israel, my glory." I love how he words this. "You are far from righteousness. I bring near my righteousness." And again, I like how the Message words this. It kind of helps frame it in a way that we can kind of get a handle on a little bit easier. He says, "Now listen to me. You're a hard-hearted bunch and hard to help. I'm ready to help you right now. Deliverance is not a long-range plan. Salvation isn't on hold. I'm putting salvation to work in Zion now, and glory in Israel." Ever have somebody in your life that was hard to help? Ever tried to help somebody who proved themselves hard to help? Sometimes, you know, it could be somebody you're trying to help out financially or something. You know, you give them a little bit of money to help them pay the rent, and you find out that they took the money and bought rims for their car or something like that. And you're like, you're working at cross purposes to what it is that we're trying to achieve here. And that's kind of the idea in this. But, you know, I look at my life and I know that I've been hard to help a lot of times in my life. I know that probably all of us can look at that and realize that's true. God calls and he warns, and he tries to hedge my path, but I just keep going full steam towards what it is that I want, towards my will and the accomplishment of my dreams. And sometimes I'm hard to help, but how wonderful is this, that even our stubbornness is not a deterrent to God's determination to rescue us from captivity. Our stubbornness cannot be matched by God's stubborn resolve to rescue us from everything that's dehumanizing us. God is way more stubborn than we are when it comes to demonstrating his love and rescuing us from these messes. Romans 5:8 says that God demonstrates his own love for us in this: while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. While we were sinning against him, while I cursed his name, Jesus was determined, set his face like a flint to go to that cross and die for me. Did I deserve it? Absolutely not. Did I earn it somehow? Am I worthy of that? No, not in the least. But this is God's love for us. This is his stubborn resolve to rescue. Where sin abounds, grace superabounds. You can't out-sin God's great love and his grace. Now, again, this isn't to send out the signal, well, Rob says that, you know, you cannot sin God's love, so I'm just going to go sin like crazy, because this is, you know, and, you know, I shouldn't, I don't have to qualify that with you guys. You know what we're saying in that. Sometimes we're hard to help, but we don't want to let that discourage us from receiving his help. We're far from righteousness at times, but he brings his righteousness near. He brings his righteousness into the mix, and that changes things. That turns everything around that way. And so this is reinforcing what he's been saying all along, that while idols that we make, all these false idols, all these false claims of the world for happiness and fulfillment and satisfaction, they're all dependent on what we can do for them. But God's care for us is not dependent on what we provide for him at all. It's completely unilateral. It rests solely on his grace for us. We don't carry this God. This God carries us. So this chapter ultimately is a summary of what he's been saying for the last two chapters, driving home this point in a repetitive way. There's no other God. I'm the only God here. The gods of your own making, they're a waste of time. They're not going to satisfy you. They're not going to fulfill you. They're definitely not going to save you. They're impotent for that. I'm the only God there is. I'm the only God there is, and salvation is going to come through me and me alone. You're not going to work it out for yourself. You're not going to make it happen on your own. You're going to have to trust me and let me carry you into that promise that I've given you. That's the idea. That there is no God besides the living God, and salvation comes from him alone. That's a timeless message. It was pertinent to Israel in the context of the looming crisis that they were going to have in going into captivity in Babylon. It was important for them to hear this, so they weren't tempted to look somewhere else for their rescue. But it's a message for us as well, as followers of Christ, a reminder that our salvation is dependent on his love, that we're not, even as his followers, immune from crafting idols. And we want to keep our eyes open and keep ourselves aware of how it is that we're developing our affections in this life, and that we're not placing them on something less than God. Because all of the things that clamor for our affections in this world are ultimately going to let us down. They're just going to increase our burdens. If we want to know salvation, if we want to know wholeness and fulfillment, we're only going to find it by committing our ways to God and loving him above any other claim on our life. And that's really the ultimate idea. Loving God beyond any other claim that anything or anyone lays on our heart. And that's the message of Scripture, and really it's our bottom line. So it becomes incumbent on us to take up that daily task, that daily determination to soften our hearts and to embrace his plan. So let's do that. Let's find his life for us, the life that he meant for us to live. Right on? All right, very cool. Well, God, we just ask you, Lord, to reinforce this truth in our lives. You know us. You know how susceptible we are to those siren calls that are out there, those things that clamor for our attention, that we have that tendency to drift away following after. So preserve us, Lord. It's one thing to say these things. It's one thing to read these things. It's another thing to live this out on that daily basis. So each day as we rise, God, enable us to have that resolve to follow you, to put no God before you, to determine that all of our affections, all of our longings, all of our desires will find their fulfillment in following you, in being the people that you intended us to be, of understanding and knowing ourselves in light of how you describe us, of finding our purpose in the advancement of your kingdom, and when your kingdom arrives, of finding our place there. Work that into our hearts and into our lives, God, by your Spirit. We yield ourselves to you, and we trust you to accomplish this. In Jesus' name, amen.